It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, a couple things. First of all, because I'm this guest elder by 9 days, she'll probably call me Mr. Mike before we get done. And but secondly, when all is said and done, she may be remembered as much for her philanthropy as for her incredible record in golf.
Oh, incredible record? You can say that again. 34 LPGA victories and 6, yes, I said 6 major championships. And what a pleasure it is to have Betsy King with us this morning. Thank you for joining Mike and I, Betsy. We look forward to this for a long time.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I think it's a great thing that you guys are doing, and I'm just feel very grateful and happy to be a part of it.
Welcome to a fellow Leo.
All right.
So as we've talked about, Betsy, what we try to do in telling your life story is start at the very beginning. So we know you were born in Reading, Pennsylvania, grew up in that area. So tell us a little bit about life in those days growing up in Reading.
Reading isn't a particularly large town. It's about an hour from Philadelphia. My parents were not from that area. My dad actually was born in Canada and moved to Rhode Island when he was about 5. And my mother was from Rhode Island. But my father ended up going to medical school in Philadelphia following World War II. He served in World War II in the Canadian Air Force. And then once he graduated medical school, he did his residency in Reading, Pennsylvania. And so that's how they ended up there. And that's how why I was born there. I have one older brother who was a year ahead of me in school. His name's Lee. And really, for me, my success as an athlete and as a professional golfer came because of him and my parents. You know, I always had somebody to play with. And whenever my brother went outside, it was take your sister. And so I ended
okay.
up. Okay. Yeah. And the poor guy. So I ended up playing with my brother and his friends in all sorts of games. And I really think a lot of the players in my era, I know Patty Sheehan and Pat Bradley and others, they all had older brothers. And so they learned to play sports, including golf, because of that. At that time, there really wasn't the instruction level that there is today. And, you know, you couldn't even see your swing on film. And so it just was something where we learned. I loved playing sports as I learned that my parents were both athletic. My dad went to college on a football scholarship at Dickinson College, and my mom is in the University of Rhode Island Sports Hall of Fame. She played sports. So it was just something that my brother and I did. They introduced us to all kinds of sports, and whatever we'd like to do, we kept doing.
I see both of you were field hockey players.
Yes. Yep. My mom played field hockey. I think in college she was field hockey and tennis and basketball. And I learned field hockey. I played 4 years in high school and actually continued at Furman for 2 years. Pennsylvania really is a hotbed for field hockey. Every Olympics, there's always players on the team from Pennsylvania. And even Berks County, where I'm from, there's been a number of players that have been Olympians on the field hockey team. So, in fact, my high school field hockey team could have beaten my college field hockey team. Just because the level of field hockey in South Carolina was not what it was in Pennsylvania. Even at the college level, it was lower than the high school level in Pennsylvania.
So you didn't take that hockey stick above your shoulder, did you?
No, I know. If it goes above your shoulder in field hockey, it's called sticks. It's they blow the whistle and the other team gets a free hit. So you do have to learn to adjust that. But I really like playing all sports. I also played basketball 3 years in college. So it wasn't until my senior year that I concentrated on just golf. But really what made me do that more than anything else was my sophomore year in college, I injured my knee 3 times, initially in field hockey and twice more in basketball. And I didn't know the extent of the injury at the time. I rehabbed it from crutches back to playing. Mm-hmm. And then eventually when I was on the tour during one off season, I had my knee scoped and the doctor's like, well, you had 5 tears in your cartilage and your ACL's gone. So, you know, I'd done that during college. And, but again, in the era that I was in, we didn't even have trainers at the women's games. So I remember once I injured my knee and I was going to PT, I was using the trainer from the football team and I had to go over to where he was and change in the supply closet in order to get treated. So it's, you know, I feel like I grew up and played in a unique era, you know, that today the girls certainly have gotten a lot more support. It's great that there's been such a change in women's sports. But on the other hand, I really do feel like I was a pioneer and had a hand in making things better for women in sports and girls.
I agree.
Kind of a tweener era for you in that Title IX had, you know, was brand new, and yet it took a while to take hold, didn't it?
It did. Like for me at Furman, my last 2 years, I had a partial golf scholarship. And that's why I could play those other sports. I wasn't on a full ride where they could say, hey, you can't do that.
Right.
But now at Furman, they have 6 full scholarships for the women's golf team. And I was instrumental along with Beth Daniel in starting a pro-am that ran for over 20 years at Furman to raise money for the golf program. We would bring in LPGA pros. I think Brad Faxon might have played in it 1 or 2 years because he went to Furman, of course. And it was we wanted to make a difference and support the program. Dottie Pepper, you know, it's interesting. Furman is such a small school, yet we had, I think to date, there's probably close to 30 professionals that have played on the LPGA tour that came out of Furman.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Hard to believe, but, you know, it happened. And, you know, we won a national championship when I was there. And having Beth there a year behind me, you know, not realizing at the time, but it was probably one of the best things to help me develop my game because we definitely pushed one another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Couple of big pushes right there.
So how old were you when you first held the golf club?
I think I was 8. I remember I started with lessons. I was in 4th grade. My brother and I took lessons together. And, you know, at the time, the club, they didn't have a range. You know, you hit balls and you know, shag your balls. So I would stand out while he was getting his lesson and pick up the balls. And then he would do the same for me. The first pro that I took lessons from, his name was Henry Poe. And this was at the Reading Country Club. And he actually was my godfather. And, I took lessons from the first teacher I took lessons with was my godfather.
Cool.
Yeah, he moved away from Reading a couple years after that to Alabama to run a course for Vanity Fair. So then I started working with other pros as time went along.
Yeah, so you took lessons and you're taught by Henry. How quickly did your game develop?
You know, probably not that quickly. The first time I played a national tournament level, I played in the U.S. Junior when I think it was between my junior and senior year in high school. My mom drove me down to Augusta, Georgia, and the U.S. Junior was at Augusta Country Club. I believe Hollis Stacey won that. I know Hollis and Amy Alcott were in the finals, and Hollis won, and I didn't even know who any of those people were. I didn't even qualify for the match play. At that time, you played 2 rounds of stroke play on site, and then it went into the match play, and I didn't qualify for the match play. And then I think, well, maybe that was when I was 16. I believe 2 years later, I went and played in the junior again because it was in New Jersey, and I could drive over there. And that time, I made it to the semifinals of the U.S. Junior. So that probably was, you know, the 2 years that I developed was in high school. I didn't play high school golf, you know, through the school because there wasn't a girls team and I wasn't allowed to play on the boys team. And so I played softball instead in the spring. And so I just competed in the summer and mostly just in Pennsylvania, except for that those two U.S. juniors. There was a Central Pennsylvania, Women's Central Pennsylvania Golf Association, and that's where I did most of my play. And then I also played, I think I won the state junior twice. There was a Pennsylvania state junior.
So you just went to Furman then. Did you started with no golf scholarship?
Correct. I wasn't recruited. You know, they really weren't doing that at the time. I just went there. My brother went to Wake Forest for 2 years. At the time, my parents had a place at Hilton Head that they would go down to, and they wanted me to go somewhere to a private school in the South. And that's what I ended up doing. In fact, I never even saw the Furman campus until I'd already been accepted as a student.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I only applied to two colleges, and I applied to East Carolina and Furman, got accepted at both. And then I saw Furman on Easter weekend, my senior year in college. I went down and I did see the campus, and it was a beautiful campus. They had their own golf course on campus. So I thought, you know, I knew the weather would be better than it is in Pennsylvania. And so I decided to go down there. I didn't know anyone at the school, no other students, you know, and obviously not the coach yet or any of the professors.
Well, they must have seen something in your game. Did your game develop sort of in steps then as you were at Furman? What were some of the key things that happened to you that helped you develop?
I played on the, I can't even remember how many people. Well, my freshman year, there was a player there named Beth Solomon, who was a junior, and she actually turned pro. Her father was a club professional, and she turned pro after her junior year. So, you know, she was the best player on the team at the time. And so I think I was learning from her. And then, you know, Beth came the following year, my sophomore year. And that year, my freshman year, I think it was my freshman year, a lady named Cindy Farrow transferred from Ithaca College to Furman. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she ended up playing on the tour. So it really was just coincidental that we ended up with the good players. I believe Beth was recruited.
Okay. Was she?
You know, she came. I remember her coming and visiting the college. You know, Beth's from Charleston, so it would make sense. And then the coach, my junior and senior year, Doc Meredith, he knew about Sherry Turner, who lived in Greenville. And actually hadn't gone to college out of high school. He talked her into coming. And so they really were the first two that were kind of recruited to play golf.
Hmm. Yeah, so how's that for a women's team?
How about that?
Betsy King, Beth Daniel, Sherry Turner, and Cindy Farrell.
Yeah,
I know. It's just fine. And we ended up winning nationals by one shot over Tulsa, who had Nancy Lopez, Nancy Aronson at the time, I think Kathy Reynolds, who played on tour. And it's funny because I saw Nancy. I went over. She lives out in the desert, in Palm Desert, and I saw her a couple of years ago. And, you know, we won by one shot, and she said, oh, one of the players backhanded a putt and missed, and she moans all that. And, you know, I'm just saying, hey, we won by one shot. I didn't know what the circumstances were.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it was a pretty good year at Furman. 1976, you and Beth and Sherry and Cindy win. Mm-hmm. And then you also played pretty good in the U.S. Women's Open that year, too, yeah, as an amateur.
Yeah. I was, you know, that probably – I played right before I went – off to college, I played in a women's professional event, an LPGA event that was in the Philly area. And, you know, I didn't break 80 either day. And then while I was at Furman, I started playing in the Women's U.S. Open. And when I had that finish between my junior and senior year, I think I tied for eighth and was low am. And that told me that maybe I had the game to play on the tour. That was really helpful for me in terms of saying, hey, maybe I can do this and continue to pursue going to the next level in golf.
Yeah, that was Rolling Green Country Club, T8 with Susie Burning, another future Hall of Famer at the time. Yeah. And Joanne Carner won that one in a playoff against Sandra Palmer.
Right, and Sandra had won the year before, and then I remember coming, and I actually drove back and forth from home each day to Rolling Green. It was about an hour away from my home, in outside of Reading, and I had a friend caddying for me that had played college golf at Furman a couple of years and then had transferred. But it was a great experience to get to play with the pros. And if you do okay, you feel like, hey, I have a shot at going to the next level.
Well, and we always love to hear about that, don't we, Bruce?
Yeah, and you made up your mind pretty quick, too. You turned pro in 1977 at the age of 22. I have to ask you, it took you a while to sort of get settled in, but you're learning all the time, making a little bit of money, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Yeah, I have to say, I think I probably have the most unusual career ever on the LPGA Tour. I don't know of another player that it took me 6.5 years to win my first event, and then I ended up winning the 34 times. Usually if you win that many times, you start winning in a year or two.
Right.
And you keep going. But for me, I remember saying to myself, well, I'm just going to be the best non-winner there's ever been on the tour.
That's good.
And I don't know if that's the best attitude to have, but what really was what changed my career, two things. One was I became a Christian in January of 1980, and it was, even though I grew up in the church, I didn't have the deep day-to-day faith as a believer, and that really changed my perspective on everything, life and then also golf, even golf, and that's when I learned to channel, hey, I got to quit. I was ultra competitive and to the point that you can actually resent other people that are preventing you from getting to your goals. So I had to change that. And it became, how can I be the best player that God's made me to be, whatever that is. And it doesn't really matter what others are doing. Right. And then at the end of 1980, in the fall, I met Ed Oldfield, who was a pro out of Chicago. And he wintered in Scottsdale. And I started seeing Ed for lessons. I actually moved to Scottsdale in the winters. I'd spent a couple winters in Florida, and then I decided to start coming to Scottsdale because of Ed. And that really, he made some changes in my swing. I won a professional event in Japan in the fall of 1981. And so I knew I was on the right track. And then when I won the first time in 1984 at the Women's Kemper Open, I just realized what it took to win. And Bruce, I'm sure you know this too. Before you win, you think, I'm going to have to play the best rounds of my life for 4 days in a row to have a chance to win. And you realize that nobody.
Not so.
It never happens. Nobody drops.
Not so.
Yeah, nobody plays perfectly, and particularly not 4 days in a row. So,
yeah.
But it's really how you recover from your mistakes and handle that. And So you learn to score without, you know, playing your best golf. And
exactly.
Once I learned that, it just made all the difference in the world. So, and then here I am, you know, 34 wins later. So.
Yeah, well, let's briefly recap, as Bruce did at the top, the playing record of Betsy King. We talked about her joining the LPGA Tour at age 22 in 1977. She had 39 professional wins, including 34 LPGA Tour victories, which is 14th in the all-time list, three Japan Tour wins, and leading money winner, 1984, 89, and 93. Player of the Year in 84, 89, and 93. Vare Trophy winner in 87 and 93. And as we mentioned, top 10 all-time in majors won with six. We'll talk about each of them. So that first win in Japan, 1981, and I'll let you pronounce the name of that tournament.
Tsuki, I believe. It's Tsuki Charity Classic. It was in Yokohama, Japan. And Tsuki, he was, I can't remember his first name, but they, from what they told me, he was like the Frank Sinatra of Japan. He was, you know, he was kind of good looking and was a singer. And so his name was on the event. And it was played the week after we were in Japan for an LPGA event. And they just were looking for some LPGA players to come. This is, I think this is kind of funny or unusual. I got $1,000 guarantee to play.
Nice.
They basically gave me an envelope with $1,000 in it. That was the guarantee.
Wow. Cash.
Cash, yeah. Cash. Nothing like cash.
And then secondly, at that time, they were still playing the small ball, golf ball in other parts of the world, including on the JLPGA. And so I'd never hit the small ball, but I tried it in the practice round and I felt like I could hit it. Like, I think I hit it about maybe 7 yards further with the irons and it
a little
seemed
straighter.
Like, yeah. It seemed like it went better in the wind. And I said, I'm going to try and play the ball. I played it in the tournament and I won the tournament. It's the only week I've ever played the ball in my life.
Interesting.
That is.
Ended up winning. I thought, oh, what the heck? I'll just try it and see what happens. So.
So you never played any small balls growing up? Because I did as a kid.
No, never. I never even saw any in Reading. I don't remember anybody. Yeah. I mean, you know, bringing them there to try. So
yeah. I would suspect being a famous singer that Miss Itsuki-san would have fit in really nice with the karaoke competition on the tour bus with the girls. What do you think?
Oh yeah, I think you would have. Oh man, those rides were. But, you know, the traffic after the last round, getting back to Tokyo, usually if we were playing outside of Tokyo, you know, what was an hour bus ride became about 3 hours. And so people just, you know, thought.
Little beverage, little karaoke singing.
Yeah. Well, the one year that was really, I thought was kind of funny. Well, it was a lot of fun was, when we played, we used to do a team event against Japan, the U.S. versus Japan. And I remember Kathy Whitworth was playing. And we did a contest and we all got up and sang different songs. And I think Whit won. I can't with whoever she sang What's Love Got to Do With It. And
with Amy Alcott.
Yeah. So they won. But it was just it was fun. That was a lot of fun. You know, it's always fun to do the team play because, you know, golf, you know, you're always individual and it's fun to be part of a team like that.
Well, Bruce and I have heard a lot of stories about the tour bus rides.
Yeah. You know, later on, and I wasn't one of the wilder ones for sure, but later on they actually divided it up that you could choose to get on the party bus or to go.
Oh, the other bus. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah. I felt badly for the driver because literally people are all just standing up in the aisle and blaring the music and in this bumper to bumper traffic. What he must have thought about being professional golfers.
Yeah, so you get on the bus either with two coolers or with just with one, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it sounded like a lot of fun. So let's go to 1984. You mentioned it was about 6.5 years before you get your first win at the Women's Kemper Open. That was at Royal Kanapali North by 3 over Pat Bradley. How did that one feel?
It felt pretty good. I know I had a lead going into the last round, and another kind of funny story. I was staying with Therese Hessian that week, who played on the tour, and she then was a women's golf coach at Ohio State for 30 years. But I think I had a 3-shot lead going in the last round, and it was telecast on NBC at the time.
Big deal, yeah.
And then Therese was Catholic, and so I happened to go with her Saturday night to Mass before the last round. And during the Mass, I remember leaning over to her and saying, "What's the largest lead anyone's ever lost on national television?" So, you know how golfers are, you get negative thoughts, you know?
Yeah.
And you just have to go beyond that. But fortunately for me, I ended up winning the next day. I don't believe I was paired with Pat Bradley. I think she was in another group. I believe I was with a Japanese player. I can't remember her name, but so anyway, in the last group, and I managed to win. So
yeah,
you did something there in the 1984 that a lot of people couldn't do, and that was validate that victory on the LPGA tour. It didn't take you very long to do that, did it? 1 month.
Yeah, no, it, as I say, once I learned what it took, your confidence just changes. And so I know the second win was at a course in Orlando. I don't remember the name of the course that we played because we didn't play there maybe 1 or 2 years.
Yes, Cypress Creek.
Yeah, and then I won in Denver. I think it was Green Gables was the third win of the year. And
correct.
That, I believe, was in either August or September. But just the floodgates opened once I won that first one.
So you mentioned it briefly, but give us a little bit more insight into what changed, because you start now a 10-year run of multi-win years.
Just as I mentioned, there's really once you learn how to win, it's that much easier. And it, to be honest, I think sometimes in our Solheim Cup events lately, the last competitions, is we've had some players on the Solheim Cup team that have not even won on the LPGA Tour. And I really think that affects their ability to perform at their best at the Solheim. There's just something about winning that once you do that, it just frees you up. Like, okay, I know what it takes, and it's not as hard as I thought it was, and I want to do it again, and all those thoughts. So anyway, that's really what happened to me, and I continued to work on my swing. You definitely have to have a level of mechanics there. And another thing that was key for me was I became a really good putter, and nobody wins a lot of tournaments without being able to putt.
Correct.
Yeah.
And correct. Who helped you with that? Did Ed help you with that?
Ed taught me putting as well. And he was old school in the mechanics that you lead with your left hand. There's no releasing the putter that they talk about today. It's more leading with the left hand and keep the blade going to the hole. Like if he would watch me for 5 minutes, he'd watch from the back, he'd watch from the side, and then he would go, okay, your hands are okay, they're forward, you're not turning it under, you're not opening it, you're not taking it back outside, you're not taking it inside, you're holding your hands, you're not breaking down. He would look at that, your head's still, you're not moving. He would just go through this checklist of mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought he was really good. I mean, he really took me from an average to, one of the best.
Top players, yeah.
So you mentioned that third win in 84, that was at the Freedom Orlando Classic. The second win, that was by 2 over Alice Miller. And then the third win was at Green Gables in Denver by 1 over Muffin.
Spencer Devlin.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. If you say so.
You're just going to have to trust us on some of this,
right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, you know, three victories in 84 and then three more again in 85, starting with the Samaritan Turquoise Classic at Arizona Biltmore. And you did something that you've done to a lot of people. You won in a playoff.
Over
Patty Sheehan.
Yeah, I don't know how she remembers that, but I remember that pretty well. It was we were paired together, and she actually going into 18, she had a 2-shot lead, and
ouch!
I know, and it's kind of a shortish par 4, and you know, I hit it on the green, not that close, and she was, I think, just left of the green, but the pin was tucked left, and she chipped it on, and I don't think, obviously it wasn't gimme, but I don't remember if it was maybe within 10 feet, and, you know, still with the 2-shot lead, and I have like a, I don't know, 25, 30 footer, I make it for birdie.
Ooh.
You know, she misses the putt for par, and so we go into a playoff, and I eagle the first playoff hole.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
It's a par 5, and I knocked it on it too and made the putt for eagle, so... anyhow, it was such a turnaround at that time.
Yeah, and then you went over to the UK and won the Burberry Women's mm-hmm. British Open at Moor Park by 2 over Marta Figueres Doty.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's not counted as one of my majors because it wasn't part of the LPGA Tour at the time. Yeah. Yeah. And there were just a few of us. IMG was running it, and so I was you know, invited by them to go. I got a guarantee to go. And I obviously enjoyed it, the experience. The guy that caddied for me was a guy named Brian Smallwood, and he's from Ireland. He lived in England, and he caddied for me over here off and on. And then he would caddy for me sometimes when we played over in England or France. And I just remember the last day the weather was pretty cold. And I think I had 4-iron in on the last hole, and I hit a really good shot, and that kind of was what sealed the win. Other than that, I don't remember a lot of the details about it.
Well, Marta had an interesting record there. She won it once and was second once as an amateur, and uh-huh. then she had 2 seconds as a pro.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think you finished second the previous year to Yako Akimoto at Woburn.
Oh, I did. Okay.
Yes.
Yep. I know. You just got to go with us on this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. I know. Like the previous year, it was part of the LPGA. It was an official event. It wasn't a major. And then, they did that for a few years before it ever became, you know, a major on the LPGA. I'm glad that it finally did. And I'm glad that I was still playing when we got to play some of the courses that the men play on. You know, like I got to play Turnberry and Royal Lytham and, oh my gosh, the one in Bridgeport area, Royal Birkdale. That was fun.
Yeah. So finishing up 85, you come close to my hometown. You're in Springfield, Illinois at the Rail Charity Classic and won by 2 over Janet Anderson.
Okay. Yeah, I had a connection with the Rail because I stayed with the daughter of the owner of the Rail. He was a local developer in Springfield, and you know, I just requested housing through the tournament, and so I ended up staying with Lois and Bill Collins, and it was Lois's father, Leonard Sapp, that owned the Rail, and so I think I won there at least twice, maybe 3 times. I don't remember, but. It was a golf course. Well, when we started playing there, it was a Robert Trent Jones, but it was pretty new. And the line that the players always said was, there's no jail at the Rail. Because the trees were pretty small and you could, you know, fly it over the corner.
Yeah.
And of course, we played there like 30 years in a row. So by that time, the trees obviously had grown up a lot. So the character of the course had changed quite a bit.
But as I recall, there were years when people really went low there.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I know the one year that one of the years I won, I shot 60. I started out 7 shots behind, and I said, someone asked me, what do you think? I said, I think I need to shoot 63 to win. And
you did.
Yeah, I shot 63 and got in a playoff and won.
Yeah. So two more wins in 86, Bruce.
That's one of them there at the yeah. Ralph Charity Classic again. And just prior to that, you win at the Hendredon Classic at Willow Creek Country Club in a playoff with Joanne Connor.
Yeah. That's probably the only time that, I went head-to-head with Joanne, you know, that we were both vying for the win at the same time. And obviously, she was one of my favorite players that I ever had the opportunity to play with. I say Joanne was... she played golf. She's the only professional that I've ever met that really played it like an amateur. And I mean it only from the sense that she went out and had a good time while she played. Like she would say on the first tee, okay, girls, let's go out there and make some birdies today.
Yeah.
And really had a relaxed attitude. I mean, even though she was competitive as, you know, very much.
Could be.
Yeah. And, you know, wanted to do well and win and all, but it really was, you know, she had won the amateur 5 times before she ever turned professional.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So she just had such a great attitude about the game. So she was always great to play with.
Tee it high and let it fly.
Yep.
You kind of wonder what record she could have posted had she not waited till age 30 to turn pro, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in her prime, she was, you know, one of the longest hitters in women's golf, probably the longest at that time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for 2, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.